Hey, welcome to the third log, the third reading log that I've been doing. I know that I'm going to be talking about deprofessionalization in this Lotosario, or maybe Lotosario by Raquel Salas Rivera / The Tertiary by Raquel Salas Rivera, one of my favorite books of poetry, one of the most compelling books of poetry I've read in a long time, and I'll get to some other things too, but that's what's going on. We'll see where this goes. This is, again, the third time I've done this log. Today is June 16th or something, I don't even know, and you probably won't be listening to this at all, but if you are, I know you're going to be listening to this far, far moment from June 16th. 2018, as I've been kind of keeping these things slight, kind of keeping them on the back burner and squeaking them out into the world. So thank you for joining me in this semi-private, semi-public space, this place where I'm just going to be talking to figure things out, mostly for myself, mostly to just get the wax off my tongue. But I would love to hear from you. I would love to hear from you at all, whatever you have to say. Deprofessionalization. Yeah, I want to talk about deprofessionalizing. The reason I'm turning to this is that recently, I've been looking for work, and I've been unemployed for a couple months. I have picked up work now, but we moved from Buffalo to Ithaca for Cheryl got a job. And this was right when I had finished my PhD work and, was trying to find a tenure track job. And last year I got to the second round on a couple. This year, I got to the second round on one, but that was at the same time Cheryl got a job in Ithaca, and the other job would have been in San Francisco. So I canceled the interview. And it was a little hard to do that, but at the same time, Cheryl's job was a sure thing, and it was something she really wanted. So we're in Ithaca now, and I started looking for tenure track jobs within 4 hours of here. Nothing showed up, and I think I'm done. I think I'm fucking done with academia. Yeah, in fact, I'm almost certain. I want to talk about that. Like, why am I done? And like, how did I get to this point? And what are the things that I learned about the state of academia, particularly the humanities, after 15 years of working in it, as an adjunct teacher, as a graduate student assistant. But the thing that really set me off, that moved me away, I think pretty decisively, was that, I was still entertaining the idea that maybe I would adjunct under the right circumstances. Somebody put me in touch with a school that was 2 hours from Ithaca and said, "Joe, I think you'd be good for this job." Somebody who had a contract left, and I said, "Okay." They took my CV, they sent it up the chain up to the dean, and they're like, "Hey, we want to hire you to teach these classes." And they said, "Well, the base salary is $2,500, but we're really, gonna see what we can do, and so we're gonna give you $3,000 a class for a grand total of $9,000 to teach three classes that are 2 hours away." And that's nothing. Like, that is nothing. That is not a livable income for me, particularly where I live, and particularly given all the driving I'd have to do. And it's not livable for most people. For somebody to take that job, which they're saving money on because they're replacing someone who had a contract with an adjunct, for someone to take that job, they're probably barely going to break even. And it's really hard to do. I mean, yes, the job was creative writing, right? And one was composition, but those are still intensive courses. You still have to put in your time and grade papers, give students feedback, be really present. So I just said no, that wasn't enough money. And I told him that. And the thing is I don't think I'm going to do much better. you know, like that's indicative of the situation of a lot of adjuncts making 3,000, 3,500 a class, which means you have to teach, you know, sometimes five classes at a time a semester if you want to support yourself. So, you know, how do I feel? I have pretty mixed feelings. You know, it felt good to turn that job down, and I recently picked up a different job outside of teaching that pays much better, so I'm real grateful for that. But I'm also sad. I trained for a long time to be a teacher, and I'm pretty good at it. You know, I can be good at it. I fucked it up sometimes, but most of the time I'm pretty good. You know, I know how to do it. I was really starting to enjoy, because I was in one place for 5 years, just mentoring students, seeing them grow, continuing to feed them, you know, helping them out, helping them get jobs, knowing a smart, young, ambitious, or creative person, and watching them grow, you know, or just helping them get through. You know, I was really enjoying that. And I was starting to figure out how I could teach, you know, as a little bit more of a leftist, you know, and get my values and what I teach in a way which still wasn't, you know, prescriptive or anything. So I feel, I mean, I'm sad. I'm sad that I'm not going to do that anymore. But, you know, the other thing that's hard is, you know, I'm trying to be a working writer, and particularly in poetry, you know, I'll never make that much money from it. When you have a tenure track job, you can feed people stuff. You can have them over to read at your college. You know, you can assign their book. You can do all the little things, you know, that a cynic might say, you know, build social capital. And if we're just reciprocal machines, help get one's work considered and noticed. It's easy to build sort of networks of academic poetry because, well, you have resources. You're using other people's money. You know, so it's going to be hard. And you get summers off. I'm not going to get summers off again. So it's going to be harder to write. It's going to be harder to keep it going. I mean, and the thing is, it may not just be hard to write, but it's going to be hard to be part of a community, because I can probably write. I can probably squeeze writing in, but it's doing all the other things, you know, writing letters to people, getting to cities, doing readings, things like that. And the thing is, you know, I want to say something about adjuncting, you know, because you might hear this and just think, well, Joe, you gave up too quickly. You know, like if academia is something you believe in, why not find a way to be in it, even if it's hard, you know, because I could cobble together enough adjunct jobs. I really could. But I don't think I can in good consciousness be part of the academic system on those terms. You know, even if I had all the energy in the world to be an adjunct, which I don't anymore. You know, I grew up working class and, you know, without much money, but I didn't experience poverty until I became an adjunct at a college for the first time. You know, I didn't know what being an adjunct meant. I thought that if I had a job teaching, that job would pay my bills. And a mentor of mine helped me get this job, so I thought they wouldn't offer me a job. I couldn't afford to work. So I moved to take this adjunct job, and I started looking around for housing, and I really couldn't find it. I had to rent a house that was half boarded up with a friend. So like half the house was boarded up and unlivable. And we were in the other half. And we had a cold winter. House was heated with propane. And we ran through the first tank of propane, which was like $500 in like a week. And we said, what the hell is happening here? We go up in the attic and we realize there's no insulation at all. And so the house is basically uninsulated, and we could not afford to heat this place. So, you know, we had to like keep that, we kept that heat at like 50 and just drag space heaters around, you know, and that's miserable. And colleges are still, many of them, investing heavily in adjunctification. There's so many colleges in which adjuncts make up 40, 50, 60% of the faculty, when 40 or 50 years ago, those numbers were far, far lower, perhaps as low as 20%. I don't know, you could probably Google it or something. But the fact is colleges are increasingly eliminating full-time teaching jobs in favor of these adjunct positions, one class at a time. You're paid a fraction of what tenure track faculty are paid. A lot of the times you get no benefits, and a lot of the times there's no security, no guarantee that you're going to get another section after they plug you in. I mean, it's a bad working relation. And most adjuncts, I mean, you probably know this, you know, most adjuncts don't move up the ladder or anything. And the other, what's the other option, you know, if I didn't adjunct? Well, for a lot of people just coming out of a PhD, you can take these one year contracts. And you have to move wherever you can and then apply for another job and then move again once your contract runs out. And maybe after a move or two, you get into a tenure track job. And some of the really talented people I know have done that. But think about this. Like, either you have to be really autonomous, you know, or have a partner that's okay moving two or three times. It means you probably don't have kids. So what are the conditions under which someone can get a tenure track job? What are the conditions under which someone can teach as an adjunct on a long-term basis and make the kinds of sacrifices that requires? Who can do that, you know, under a system that's relying this heavily on adjunct labor, right? After getting all that schooling, after going into debt, who can really afford that? And if colleges have a hard time hiring professors who are people of color, hiring genderqueer, disabled folks, this is a big part of the problem. Because folks who are traditionally economically marginalized cannot be expected to stay in the game in the same way that, you know, middle class kid whose parents pay for them to get through college or have a strong safety net who can tighten their belt for a couple years while they bounce around can. It's just fucked up. And I don't want to be contributing to that kind of labor situation. And I know that there are some colleges in which adjuncts are fighting the good fight and unionizing, and that's awesome. You know, maybe I would be a part of that, but to just be plugged in somewhere without a strong labor activist movement or benefits, you know, I just can't do it. In a lot of ways, the pathetic labor situation at universities, it's like the sun, you know, for people who are in it. You know, people can get really fired up about all kinds of issues, but they don't want to look at what's happening at their own workplace a lot of the times, because it just burns, the issue burns too bright, you know, it hurts to look at it. But I do wonder why we're not looking at some work which is a little more self-aware about the labor conditions in the university. I think there was a book called Ursula in the University. There's Jill Magi's Labor. You know, it's not something that in the poetry world people really get excited to talk about, you know, the labor situation in which all these things happen. You know, even my favorite my favorite, you know, leftist podcasts don't really talk about the university, even though that they, it is the institution that they are embedded in, or which supports their work. Good exception would be the Season of the Bitch podcast. It did an interview with Jane McMickleby. I probably pronounced that wrong. And man, she calls out instructors and professors, tenure track professors, and says they are the ones that have to get on board with organizing in universities. They're the ones that have the most power within the structure of the university to affect change. And they also have security. Yet tenure track professors are often the ones that are resisting like pushes from their graduate students and pushes from other workers in the university, or at least just so paralyzed and numb to it that they do nothing. So if you're a motherfucking tenure track professor, get your shit in the game. Please, please. I mean, I've been real grateful for a lot of folks I know who are tenure track professors who've, you know, who've looked after their own house, who've looked after their own workplace and its health. And I appreciate y'all. I appreciate you a lot. And I know that some of you have enough on your plate and you're doing good in the world in other ways. But, man, I don't know. So I'm not going to be in academia as a teacher. I don't know. I mean, I guess I'm facing the question of how do I have a writing life outside of it, you know? And what are the possibilities in that? I'm hoping, and by saying it, I'm trying to hold myself to it, but one of the things I'm happy with is, you know, less time in the university, the more time I can spend in my local community. Being involved with social justice work as it happens, learning on that level what's going on and thinking about how I can write alongside it. And there, I've seen some amazing people do work in that vein, you know, that I hold up as models. Kaya Sand, you know, her Remember to Wave is pretty badass, and I know she's working in the nonprofit world. Raquel Salas Rivera is, you know, I think they washed out, you know, they didn't wash out, they quit academia, and they're, you know, deep in the Philly community, and I think that's amazing, you know. Yeah, maybe we should start a non-academic poets union or something. And somebody I've known about him, but I didn't really know what they've been up to, you know, or their circumstances. But someone like Sean Thomas Daugherty has been inspiring in terms of how he's done work outside academia and calls academics on their bullshit a lot of the times. I mean, he's worked at Pool Halls and I think is now a home health care aide or something like that. And he still writes his ass off. And it also makes me think, if the university has been neoliberalized, and if they can't be saved, then what are alternative institutions of education? You know, I think that's a question I'm going to keep thinking of. You know, education, cooperatives, alternative college, alternative or community education. You know, I don't know. I hope I have the guts to get into something like that. So, I should probably stop talking, right? I mean, you know all this. You know how fucked up the university is. You know how bad adjuncting is. How departments are getting cut down to the bone. You know, and that we got to do something about it. Or if you're still in academia, you know. Might want to see what you can do. But for now, I think I'm going to deprofessionalize. I ran across this guy, Gustavo Esteva, in his book Commenting, and he described himself as a deprofessionalized academic. So maybe that's the label I'll strive to achieve, is a deprofessionalized academic. All right. I said I wanted to speak to get the wax off my tongue, but that's not true. The other reason I've been doing these reading notes is that there are some books of poetry. There are some books of poetry that, to me, it would be a delight. It would be an amazing pleasure if everyone I knew had read them and we were talking about them and we were carrying those words forward and those poets forward. Into the world and into conversation. And that's the case with Raquel Salas Rivera's Lo Terciario. See, my Spanish is bad, but you can listen to me make a clown of myself, / The Tertiary. This is, to me, one of the most compelling books I've read in years. And I'm going to just be hyperbolic. That's just the way it's got to be when a book... kind of defeats my language when a book is doing so many things that I respond so intensely to, and also though that I've been waiting for poetry to do, because they're enunciating ideas and stances that somehow are sort of sidestepped a lot of the time in poetry or circled around but never quite put forward. I think that this is a book that does a lot of things that poetry needs to be doing. But that's not a great way to talk about a book. It is its own thing. It's Raquel's book. It doesn't have any relationship to what poetry needs or what I need or anything like that. So this book is written in Spanish and English, or I think what Raquel calls somewhere Puerto Rican dialect. So it's a bilingual book from Timeless Infinite Life. Half is printed in Spanish. You flip it over, and then the other half is English. Raquel translates it themselves back and forth, just as they say they translate the world. And they say that there is pain, history, but also refusal in this book. Where to start? A lot of the poems... I mean, I think the brilliance of the poems, the thing that's so compelling to me is how they seem to so effortlessly telescope in and out of big ideas, statements about imperialism, the colonial debt, which is like a form of violence against the people of Puerto Rico. And then this long engagement with Marx that begins the collection. There's these poems that have called the debt production process that engage with lines from Marx, who I think Raquel says a lot of Puerto Rican leftists were engaging in the 70s and 80s. But then written into those poems, written into, you know, sort of the systemic critique, our experience. We could look at page 13. When considering use values, one must always presuppose their quantitatively determined character. Okay, so we've got some Marxism there, such as the dozens of times I've passed Alabuzu's statue without seeing it, one tuna factory, a ton of sharks that eat from the discharge, etc. The fictio iuris prevails in me, since I do not possess a thorough knowledge of sharks, or how and so now we're slowly moving from these like sort of abstract Marxist statements to sort of its manifestation in Puerto Rico. A thorough knowledge of sharks, you've got this factory, you've got the sharks, or how the factory creates an imbalance in the coastal ecosystem, or how I created an ecological imbalance in my second girlfriend's family ecosystem when I ate from the discharge. The body of a commodity is in fact a use value good. And so look at what, I mean, that like just in a short space, you know, you get this tuna factory, but then also this relationship. It's about the country. It's about how capital is operating in Puerto Rico, but it is also personal and interpersonal. My second girlfriend's family ecosystem, and the way that it moves back and forth is really compelling. And I think I read somewhere, you know, in one of Raquel's interviews, which are totally worth reading. I think there's one in The Bustle, and there's another one out there too. But that, you know, like that they'd been reading Marx, but but so much is missing from Marx. Puerto Rico is not in Marx. Queerness is not in Marx. Non-binary gender is not in Marx. Colonial debt relations are not in Marx. So these things have to be written in. And so it's an engagement with Carlito, in a rewriting of it in this way, which I think is so, it's so goddamn. I'm gonna say it compelling, and it's smart. It's very, yeah. I mean, I feel like I'm learning a lot reading this. It's not like smart in that like, oh, I recognize this is having some ideas I like, but as instructing me, as having something to say, and a tremendous command of it, and how it, like, the poems are on a yo-yo, moving between these registers of the academic and systemic to the personal to the nation. It's just, man, it's so good, and I think that those things light each other up. They help illustrate and complicate each other. One of the other things that really appealed to me in this collection are the ways in which Raquel's poems are not afraid to call out specific people. And so yeah, this guy Jason Benick, you know, that this guy capital, this capitalist, not just capitalism, you know, because they say, you know, in the Anthropocene, capitalism, you know, the capitalist scene is the idea. The Anthropocene is that man is the largest geological force in the world, and that geological force is going to cause extinction. The capitalist scene is that capital is the geological extinguishing force. But we got to remember, capitalists are people, and I love that Raquel calls out specific people. Jason Benick has confirmed that his company can produce 3 new beaches by filling in the straits. So there you have this earth mover, you have this geological force that is a person. So you have your Jason Benicks. The other thing I really admire about these poems is they also don't lose track of people.